Jamaica is in a position where our economic output for the December quarter of 2022 was higher than our economic output for December 2019. Our unemployment is low.
We are in a unique company globally who can say economic recovery, jobs recovery, but in addition, debt is lower today than prior to the pandemic.
Jamaica is one of the few countries that has recovered from the fiscal wreckage left by the pandemic by consolidating public finances and actually lowering public debt. But
some people wonder whether more efforts should be devoted to foster growth. What are your views on this?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question, but I think the answer for us is quite clear. It's one thing to look at the average rate of growth. It's an entirely other thing to look at the volatility of growth. And Jamaica's experience of decades of macroeconomic instability has taught us that macro instability makes growth volatile, makes it uncertain, and economic shocks exacerbate and cause other shocks, and recovery periods get elongated.
In this program, Jamaica's Minister of Finance, Nigel Clark, sits down with the IMF's Rodrigo Valdez to talk about how Jamaica's rocky economic past informs its policy decisions for the future.
In Jamaica's history, we had economic decline in the 1970s due to economic shocks as well as social turmoil. The economy declined in 1976, 6.5%, declined in 1977, declined in 1979, declined in 1980. It was not until 1989 that we recovered to pre-1976 levels of economic output. That's a 14-year recovery period. In the global financial crisis, the economy declined in 2008, declined in 2009, declined in 2010. The largest just been about 3%. It took until 2018 to recover to 2007 levels of economic output. And there, we weren't having conversations about stability or compression or anything like that. Now, that kind of long recovery periods stunts economic development. And if you look at the data from another point of view, we started measuring growth quarterly in 1997. Between 1997 and 2015, we had 37 quarters of economic growth and 33 quarters of economic decline. When you compare that with the United States, looking at quarterly growth measured year over year, they had 76 periods of growth and 4 of decline over the same period. Now, when you look at what we've been able to achieve during this period of stabilization, though it involved trade-offs, though it involved compression, we had 20 consecutive periods of quarterly growth between the end of 2015 and 2019, the longest period of quarterly, unbroken quarterly growth since we started measuring it in 1997. Prior to that experience, we only had quarterly growth stretches to a maximum of 9 quarters. 3 quarters of growth, then decline. 4 quarters, then decline. The maximum was 9. And with the stabilization effort, though it involves a trade-off, though it involves compression, what comes with it is less volatility, longer periods of growth, it elongates the economic cycle and gives us a greater chance for economic development.
Let me turn now to the side of the fund. We're very pleased to have been the opportunity to support Jamaica in this endeavor. But it's not always the case that the fund has success, and where other cases where things get more complicated. What would you say we need to change and to do better?
Well, I mean, in the case of Jamaica, it's not the fund alone. In the case of Jamaica, what you have was a country that wanted to reform, that wanted to change, that made the reforms its own. The principles are common, but how those principles find expression in a particular country, and in the case of Jamaica, it found expression through our own ownership of the program goals. In terms of what you can do differently, you know, fund programs don't only operate in an economic context, they operate in a political, economic context. And understanding the goals and aspirations of the people, what they have been through and their history, I think is a very important part of translating broad principles into actionable, implementable steps that countries can own for themselves.
Talking about politics, how did you manage to produce this consensus, this political consensus, to move forward with the program and with this period of efforts for a better future?
Well, Jamaica has engaged in this sort of consolidation effort over the past 10 years, beginning in 2013. And prior to 2013, we'd have had a young prime minister take the reins of government at only 39 with all intentions to do the right thing, and came to the people of Jamaica and said, told them the truth back in 2010, that bitter medicine was to come. Well, he promptly lost power and served for the shortest time in Jamaica's history. But what that meant was that an incoming government had no choice but to implement austerity in the context of an outgoing government that formed opposition, that campaigned on it and lost. Jamaica never had a better chance in terms of the political forces at work. And that provided a platform that was leveraged to the credit of the government that followed. And Jamaicans reacted with horror to find out that the sacrifices they had made in the first fund program of 2010 had to be repeated and deepened. And here we're talking about debt exchanges and wage freezes, and therefore demanded that they be at the table for the conversation. And what started out as a, you know, I said, a public sector equivalent of a creditor committee, an internal creditor committee, it gained social credence with the inclusion of the unions and academics. And Jamaica innovated this concept of stakeholder oversight and involvement that we call the Economic Oversight Committee, which was a key innovation that has lasted across administrations and has been exported to other parts of the world. So I break the 10-year period down into those first 3 years under the previous administration and the last 7 years under the current administration. And one thing that is a truth across all democracies is that policies will continue if they have domestic support. Now, in generating domestic support for the continuation of stabilization policies and policies that right the structural imbalances in the Jamaican economy has come about because we've been able to demonstrate their effectiveness and we've been able to strategically share the gains. Never before in Jamaica's history have people been able to see the pace and scale of development, both private sector-led and public sector investment as we have today. And that is, you know, a demonstration effect that we are onto something good. We're experiencing a positive that we've, a major positive that we've not before. And by making sure that we continue to share the gains across stakeholders in the population, we've managed to maintain support for this path. Jamaica, like other countries in the Caribbean, we consider ourselves on the front line of this climate change reality. For us, it's not a debate. It's a reality that we experience on an annual basis. The intensity,
So just a quick reminder here that you're listening to Nigel Clark, Jamaica's finance minister, and the IMF's Rodrigo Valdez. And they're about to start talking about how Jamaica can deal with the impact of climate change. You'll notice they refer to something called the RSF, or the Resilience and Sustainability Facility, which is essentially a special fund available to countries that are vulnerable to climate and to health risks like a pandemic.
Let me switch more now to the future and move to climate change and what Jamaica is doing. Now we have been supporting Jamaica with an RSF. And the question is, what do you expect of this agenda? How can you protect, reconcile climate-related objectives with fiscal prudence?
So let me just say that, you know, that I find the RSF to be an incredible instrument, one that we have lobbied for a long time, concessional kind of funding that recognizes the broader dimensions of vulnerability. 20-year funding from the IMF, 10-year moratorium, unheard of. And, you know, so as that product was developed, we made sure that we were one of the first to access it. The good thing about it is not only money, even though it's money that comes at a critical time, rising global interest rates, refinancing challenges, and we are able to pre-finance our refinancing with this facility. But it also comes with the support for the kind of climate finance-related reforms that is allowing us to crowd in private investment. With the RSF, we have been able to update our public-private partnership regulatory and policy framework by ensuring that climate-related and green considerations are a part of the PPP policy mix. We've updated our public sector investment program to make sure that the screening and prioritization of public investment projects takes on a climate resilient lens. And we've also tabled policies on electric vehicles as we try to accelerate that transition to a more energy secure future, recognizing that energy for motor cars is about half of the energy that we import. Now, these reforms, we've been able to leverage to access financing that makes green infrastructure projects more feasible. The challenge with developing big green infrastructure projects is that, one, it takes money to prepare the projects and bring them to market. And you're competing for scarce resources for which there are high priority areas to which they can be deployed, social expenditure being one prime example. And having a project preparation facility which allows us to prepare these projects for the market without competing with other high priority areas helps us to accelerate the emergence of these projects. And yesterday we announced that with the leadership of the fund and in collaboration with the Inter-American Development Bank, the Green Climate Fund, the European Investment Bank, the United Kingdom government, and the government of the European Union, putting together a project preparation facility for green and climate resilient investments. And we also are domesticating through these reforms, being able to attract capital to allow us to domesticate green financing resources. You know, infrastructure projects that are going to be strengthened with climate resilience considerations are often more expensive. And because they're more expensive, they sometimes are not financially feasible and you have to blend financing in. The government can't undertake it all, so it goes to the market for a PPP structured approach, but the private investor needs to finance the delivery of that project. But if you're going to burden that investor with climate expectations, making it more resilient, putting bolts, nuts and bolts on it to make it resilient to disaster and make it, more eco-friendly, then you're imposing costs on the investor. Now, how do you make it affordable for the government to buy the service from this PPP if you're increasing the cost? One way is to blend in other kinds of financing. And the innovation that I'm very excited about that we announced yesterday is that rather than going to the Green Climate Fund in South Korea on a project-by-project basis, on an isolated basis, we are domesticating financing on a portfolio basis in Jamaica, with the government taking the lead with a first loss layer and, you know, having multilaterals and bilaterals come in. And so our projects can have access to the blended sort of green financing to make them more feasible. And these are the kinds of innovations that become possible by embracing, you know, some of the climate reforms that I mentioned earlier. And of course, the third prong is the European Investment Bank, who has committed to provide grant funding and long-term 30-year funding, 10-year moratoria for, you know, projects that are climate resilient and that take advantage of the climate finance reforms that Jamaica has undertaken with the support of the RSF.
Thank you. Thank you. Very interesting. Let's give a round of applause to it.
That was Jamaica's Minister of Finance, Nigel Clark, speaking with IMF Western Hemisphere Department head, Rodrigo Valdez. The event took place as part of the Governor Talks series held during the annual meetings in Marrakesh last month. You can watch a webcast of the event at imf.org. You'll also find more of these IMF podcasts, literally hundreds of them, at imf.org/podcasts or on the platform of your choice. You can also follow us on X, what used to be Twitter, at imf_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.